I'm Rabbi Matthew Ponack, and welcome to We're In This Shift Together, an optimistic yet candid collaboration of secular and spiritual discourse to address our world's most pressing needs. I'm joined today by Rabbi Joel Goldstein, a friend and scholar of Jewish law, Talmud, and a real expert in the field of all things Jewish. Welcome, Joel.
Thank you, Matthew. It's such a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to get to ask you questions. I'm really excited about this. Maybe I'll give a very quick background, and I'll ask. Matthew mentioned to me that this practice called Oasis Time. I have that right, correct?
That is correct.
Which is a Sabbath-like practice, and I think it's a universal Sabbath, but I'll have you explain more. So maybe I'll just start with that. Matthew, do you mind describing Oasis Time for us? What is it?
Well, the title, first of all, comes from a book by a psychologist by the name of Marilyn Paul, who wrote a book called An Oasis in Time, How a Day of Rest Can Save Your Life. And she is someone who is fairly traditional in her Jewish practice, and also a best-selling author. And often what she's doing is she is combining Jewish wisdom with the needs of today. And she basically articulated something that I've dreamed about for a long time, which was, how can we take the Jewish spiritual technology, if you will, the Jewish idea, the Jewish practice of Shabbat, rest and spiritual refreshment, and bring it to a broader scene? Because there are people all around the world who can use more rest and refreshment in their lives. And also, there is a really important distinction between relaxing and having Shabbat and having a spiritual refreshment, because we can relax in front of the TV. You can, you know, crack open a beer or a beverage of choice and enjoy the game. And that is relaxing, but for people who have experienced Shabbat, it's a different feeling. It's a refreshment that's not just sort of a temporary relaxation from your mind that might be thinking about things, but a really holistic, a deep tapping into the wellsprings, not just of the mental or the emotional, but the spiritual and physical as well. So Oasis Time is what we're doing in our family right now, and what I'm increasingly writing about and putting into the world, which is a Shabbat-inspired practice.
Interesting. And so we'll come back in a second to like what some of those practices are in particular, because I'm very curious about that. But first, I wanted to ask you, just in terms of, you know, this refreshment time, as I'm going to call it for the moment, where you're refreshing. For what are we refreshing when we do that? And the second question is this something that's unique to Jews? Like, in other words, do other cultures already have a Sabbath that is similar, or are we the only ones who have it?
These are good questions. First of all, so what are we refreshing? I could say, I don't want to speak too broadly about we, but I can say when I'm talking about being spiritually refreshed, is in our world, it's very easy to get away from our self, that there is always something to be done, and the work is important. Hopefully we can align ourselves, I think, in the ideal sense, that the work we can be one where we're really helping people in ways that we can. And it's very easy to get overwhelmed by that. There is a subtle part of all of us that is kind of shy and tends to retreat when we don't give it space. So you can think about someone you might know in your life who's really deep and thoughtful, but they only speak up when you give them room, when you stop talking for a few seconds and let them lead. I experience my inner world like that, that if I am so busy and hurried in my life, which, again, the work I'm doing in the world, I feel very passionately about. It's good work, but if I don't take time very intentionally to take a break, there are stirrings within me that won't have expression. And those parts of me that want to come out best when I create a space for them. And sometimes it's just about relaxing and feeling good and kind of tapping in to that essential, I think the freshness, the refreshment of reality itself is a lot of what it's about. But often in those moments, in those modes, there's information that comes forward. I'll have realizations. Oh, the reason I've been so off in my work week is because I didn't realize there was something else happening. And it's really interesting how actually cultivating intentional rest can help the work life, but only if we don't go in there with the intention to do so. It's like, I'm going to work really hard on relaxing. No. Tap into it, you know, experience that. Like, I would associate it in Kabbalah with the Shekhinah, right? Like, not just me. The Kabbalists would associate Shabbat with the Shekhinah, but that sense of presence, there's the refreshing waters of existence. And so it's really just about refinding that and having a regular weekly or biweekly or monthly or daily, whatever you need, and getting in touch with that. So that's question number one. And number two is, yes, there are many cultures in the world that have a version of Sabbath. I mean, the concept of finding spiritual refreshment must truly be universal, just like though most people have, if they have a meditation practice in our culture, it's quite often inspired by Buddhism in some way. Every culture has some version of intentional mental exercise or physical exercise that's meant to harness the power and the transformation of the mind. That's all over the place, but the Buddhas happen to have cultivated that in a very particular and refined way, which is now a benefit to people all over the world. And I cannot say with, you know, true certainty, because there's so many cultures in the world and religions, and there's already a lot of traditions that have been very inspired by Judaism. And I think there's still a lot more that Judaism has to offer as far as presenting Shabbat to the world. So yeah, it's not hard to find people who use the word Sabbath in the Christian world, for example. How many of them are doing it for the full 25 hours, for example, or how many of them have a sense of, I know it's not that uncommon for people to have meetings on Sundays at church, or even Seventh-day Adventists. Often it's a day of church in the morning, and then there's the meetings throughout the day, and that might be refreshing on some level, but there's also the way the Jews do it is different. There's this sense of, like, let's honor this time. Let's not try to construct reality right now. Let's just appreciate what we have. That means, thankfully, I think for a lot of rabbis, no board meetings on Shabbat.
It's great you say that, because I actually wanted to get into this question of, right, the Jewish Sabbath, as I'm sure many people are aware, right, it happens once every 7 days for a 24-ish, 25-hour period. Is that frequency and that that length, are those important?
I think they are important. Are they like a must-have for Oasis time? My personal answer is no, and I'm inspired by people like Reb Zalman Schachter Shalomi, who, though he was quite orthopraxic, he was, you know, living a fairly traditional life, certainly when I knew him in his later years, he would encourage people to have what he was calling tap into organic time. So organic time is when we're listening to our bodies and our soul and our emotions, and we're really going with the flow. And he associated that with Shabbat, which is really interesting, because Shabbat could be really structured. But he was saying this idea of organic time can be really, what do you need right now? How can you tap into that? How can you create a context, even for 30 minutes in the evening, light a couple candles and ask yourself, like, what do I need? How can I find refreshment right now? Maybe that's a nap. But he was sort of, at least in my world, famously telling Rabbi Tirza Firestone, you need Shabbat every day. So I don't think it's easy to equal this idea of this sort of from the Friday evening to Saturday evening, or from evening to evening, or really like a full morning, midnight to midnight, if you whatever you want. It's hard to equal that length of time in terms of its beauty and potential. Or, right, there are also Jewish laws about being able to elongate that even. You could go even further, and I really love that idea, especially if it involves not driving and what that could do for our air and our environment. Or Buy Nothing Day that's extended for half the week, potentially. There's a lot of ideas here, but the way that my wife Melina and I are thinking about it, and the way that I talk about it more publicly, is this is a practice that can help you for 15 minutes a day if that's all the time you have. And if you want to make it into a full day ritual, here's some ideas on how to do that.
Great. So I have so many questions for that. First off, just about structure, because you mentioned, you know, how structured it has to be. So how structured is it? Maybe even walk us through the day. And my other question, let's start with that. Walk us through the day. What does it look like for you personally, you and Melina, to do all this time?
Sure. So the structure we have established is based, I wouldn't even say based loosely, it's inspired by the structure of the three meals of the traditional Shabbat practice, and the kind of the entering into it, and Havdalah, the separation ritual at the end. More or less, we take some liberties with it. So one of the liberties, and this is something that I'm not usually talking about so publicly, but for the sake of conversation and the discourse, I want to say that we often are doing it starting Saturday evening as opposed to Friday evening. Now, that's not something that's set in stone for us, but both of us, you know, we lead busy lives, and as much as I kind of respect people who are able to pull off a really amazing Shabbat and Shabbat meal with a clean house and, you know, the tablecloth on the table on Friday night, that doesn't feel so realistic to us a lot of the time. So we actually take Saturday to prep, and what a day it is for prep, because it's a weekend and we can really take a lot of space with that. So the idea is that, for example, in Israel, the weekend really, even though it's a day and a half, some people do get two full days, and that's Friday and Saturday in Israel, and then Sunday is their first day of the work week. So our weekend happens to be Saturday and Sunday, so we are starting on the equivalent of our Israeli Friday is a Saturday. And that is how we're doing the prep, and then we're going into Saturday night and all the way into Sunday evening, and then we flow into our first day of the work week, which is Monday. So that's how it's situated in the week. And what it looks like, so a lot of it is prep. As anyone who's a traditional Shabbat observer knows, you can't have the practice itself without a good amount of preparation. And so we clean the house, we prepare our meals in advance so that we're not cooking on that day. And even though when I was more of a Shabbat observer in that sense, maybe not in a more orthopraxic way, but I would kind of, I never liked the idea of not cooking. I was like, oh, it's not work to cook. But the more I've tapped into that, actually it's a lot of work to cook. So we will warm things up, but we will cook all of our meals. We get our best food, like my favorite food, we save for that day. And we put a tablecloth on the table because there is something really special about that. We invite guests over and I could go really, really detailed, but basically we have a candle lighting ritual at the beginning with songs. I play music. We sing. We have usually the kids or who's ever there. We try to do something that's pretty accessible for different ages. Everyone says a gratitude as they light a candle. We have a food blessing. It's original. It's sort of, again, based on the idea of some other food blessings we've come across. And we also have what I'm calling the good vibes blessing, but is inspired by the Jewish kiddush. So it's a way to bring holiness to the occasion. It's an acknowledgement of the difference between work and rest and all the blessings that come upon us when we really acknowledge that the world is good and the world is complete today in this moment. There's sleep. and then there's another meal on the next day. We always try to get childcare, whether it happens or not these days during the great resignation of babysitters is another question. But we try to have some time to ourselves, together, Melina and I, and more guests, more meals, and eventually we're ending with Havdalah, which right now is fairly similar to the traditional Havdalah with the words. It's a really beautiful ritual. I like it as it is, and I have a desire to rewrite it, because as much as I love it and I feel connected to it, I also, because it's not Shabbat, it's Oasis time, I want to create something that feels like that, but is a little bit different. And I feel a bit more comfortable being universal with that and being ritually playful with a slightly altered Havdalah, at least.
So, that's great. Thank you. I appreciate that. So I have a couple of follow-up questions to that. First, you said you tend to have guests over, right? Just like it's typical on the Jewish Sabbath. So how have guests responded to this?
Well, by and large, people have been really overcome by its beauty. It's gone really well. We've had, especially I can say there's a few families we've had over who are fairly deep spiritual Christian practitioners. People who are, again, like myself, like Melina, they come from a tradition, but they've really learned from a lot of different places. They're inspired by a lot of different traditions and wisdom. And they're just deep spiritual people. And they come and they've loved it. It's, you know, they can really feel that the spirit that's there. And so I know we've also had some people from the Jewish community come over who are usually, I mean, I think, I don't know what it would be like for the average Sabbath observing family, right? Like a Shomer Shabbat Jewish family. Yeah. Most people, well, maybe it would vary, but some people want to invite everyone over because they want to have people exposed to it. And it's sort of, I know Shabbat tables are a very common tool of outreach that people, oh, come to our table and enjoy this, you know. And I can say for us is we want to invite people over who we think are going to like it and are going to be inspired by it, because it's new. This isn't an ancient custom, right? I think people who come over usually feel like it's an ancient custom, if you know what I mean, because we're Jewish and I'm a rabbi and we're inviting them over, and whether they're Jewish or not, it has a lot of Shabbat flavor. But the people who we invite over, we invite them because we think they're going to vibe with it. It would be difficult to invite people into a space like that, which, because it's new and because it's out of the box, there's some vulnerability there. So inviting people over who I expect will really dislike it or feel awkward or, you know, something like that, it's a bit tough right now. Maybe one day we'll feel more outbound, but by and large, it's been a positive reception. And, you know, in this line of work, Rabbi Joel, as rabbis, even no matter who it is, whether they're Jewish congregants or not, most people tend not to give the rabbi direct feedback about their ritual leadership. So, if you know what I'm saying, sometimes it's hard to tell. You know what I mean? It's sort of someone's heart of hearts, yes. what arises for them. But regardless, it's been a positive experience. And you know, when you're in the flow, right? And that's kind of, for me, the measure. So if we want to talk about Jewish law and halakha and its goals, right? So I would say, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, in the classic codes, the goal is to keep the laws, right? It all comes down to that. Like, if yeah. someone's a good Jew, if they're observing the ritual practices and the kindness rituals, if you will, and the ways of being Jewish outlined there. And in this system, the ultimate measure, it's not like the other things don't matter, but the ultimate measure of oasis time is, does it make us feel like we've entered into an oasis? And, you know, not every single time necessarily, you know what I mean? You have to kind of give yourself some slack with how it's going. But if it's not, if it's consistently not getting there, it's time to reevaluate, because that is the measure. And it's usually easy to tell if people come over and they're vibing. It's like, oh, yeah, here we are all together in this space.
Yeah. So I want to ask now, you said there's been a positive experience having people over, but have you gotten pushback giving either of someone who's come over or someone who, you know, has this idea has been presented to, like what has their response to it been in terms of negative responses, and how have you dealt with that?
Yeah, so Malina and I have done one public presentation of this idea, and it was met primarily, like if you want to look at the numbers of people who came and responded, most people were very open to it and curious. And then there was two or three who had reservations, and two of the people were not from, well, one of them was local here in the Jewish community in Victoria, and someone else was from elsewhere in Canada. And they were older, and not that that necessarily would define how they reacted, but I tend to hear more reactions like theirs from an older crowd. And it was mostly in the form of I would say, pointed questions. It was less direct statements, but the questioning kind of gave the implicit sense that they were uncomfortable with what we were doing. And because I'm a rabbi, especially, to be experimenting with something like this, Shabbat on a Sunday, you know, you can read our article, Shabbat on a Sunday, says the rabbi, you know, that there's something, I guess, it almost felt like there was a sense of betrayal there. Or there was a sense of, oh, you represent us, and we have claimed Saturday as our holy day, and here you are kind of messing with that. And someone, I was saying, well, you know, Judaism has changed over time. If you look at the Talmud, right, they were trying to basically rebuild, and they, through that, those hundreds of years of dialogue in the Talmud starting, right, like 2,000 years ago or so, they basically created what we today call the prayer service, and our tradition of the prayer service arose out of the destruction of the temple. And I was, you know, we were kind of engaging in that arguing, right, that good debating. And the response I got from someone was, well, the sages of the Talmud didn't destroy the temple. And here you are, and I was accused of destroying the temple of Shabbat, which I don't think I'm doing. And I responded and said, look, people can practice whatever they want. This is what we're choosing to do. And really, when I, like, I'm writing a book right now on Oasis Time, and the idea is I'm not going to say, here's when you have to do it. It's find a time that works for you. Here's some ideas. I want people to be connected to spiritual refreshment. And that's the bottom line. If they choose to do it one day or another, to me, because the end goal is to find refreshment, that doesn't matter. And so at the same time, upon reflection, it was kind of a compliment that someone thought that little old me, right, the first time I'm ever talking publicly about Oasis Time, has already destroyed the Temple of Shabbat. I mean, that's a pretty big feat. These are some of the responses I've gotten, and I try to respond, but I also want to keep kind of a compassionate awareness around it too, because I think ways that I'm talking about this, I am a rabbi, and I need to be aware that some people are going to feel, I think, troubled or disturbed or traumatized to some degree that someone who they, I think, implicitly or subconsciously desire to represent and uphold the tradition is challenging it so much. But that's part of my own path in this life, is someone who is inhabiting a role most people associate with traditionalism, but I'm not coming at it from that angle. I'm coming at it as an innovator.
Great. So I want to push you a little bit here, if that's okay.
Please do.
Where, you know, you said you made a comparison between, you know, the rabbis and the temple's destroyed. There are no sacrifices anymore. The rabbis invent prayer, essentially. Although maybe it's invented even before that, right? In the book of Daniel already, there's prayer, definitely. You know, in that case, the destruction happened, and they, you know, emerged from the destruction. You say they didn't destroy the temple. But in this case, Shabbat hasn't been destroyed, right? Shabbat still exists, and yet you're creating something new. So is that a good comparison?
Well, I would argue that the temple, so to speak, that has been destroyed is our thoughts and feelings about the nature of God and the universe. A lot of what the Talmud puts forward, which eventually becomes what we call Judaism, aka Rabbinic Judaism, is based on an understanding of reality that most people aren't holding anymore. And that doesn't mean they can't practice it, but if there was a destruction of the temple, so to speak, that allows someone like me to feel like it's open season on innovation, it would be closer to what Nietzsche was talking about in Thus Spoke Zarathustra, God is dead. And the character, the main character, is going around and saying God is dead, and people just, they just blink at this character because they don't understand what's happening. But there's a lot, I see a lot of similarity between that story and Rabbinic Judaism right now, that there has been a really fundamental shift in our culture's, you could call it theology, if you could even call it theology anymore, right? Not even views of God, views of reality, views of what's going on here, views of reward and punishment. And I think for a lot of us, and when I say us, I mean Jewish people, but I also just humanity, Western civilization, for sure, for a lot of people, it's not about upholding a set of laws or practices because God said so, or because, you know what I mean, we're supposed, or even because this is what we do as a people. The idea that these things should be beholden to their practicality and to their ability to move us and impact us and improve our lives, I actually think that's pretty widespread right now. So though people still traditionally practice Shabbat, most Jews do not. And it's not because they don't know enough about it. It's because it's not compelling to them in their current mind state and what they're looking for. So if I were to make a comparison about the destruction, so to speak, of the Temple of Shabbat, I would say that it was the Enlightenment and the Holocaust that really challenged the Jewish view of the world so greatly that the idea that we were being rewarded or punished by God, kind of went out the window. And people are in a different place right now. And in many ways, this comes from those ruins, the theological ruins from our modern era.
Yeah, it's you know, what's also fascinating about that is I think, and this gets lost, is that there is a deep connection in Jewish literature between Shabbat and God, right? That, you know, Shabbat starts with an action of God. It's about a relationship with God. We may actually even look at a text later that says it's like a special gift to us from God. And so it's and even to the extent I will say, there's two rabbis, one Rashi. And then later the Aruch Laner, who's in 17th century Germany.
This is why I appreciate you, Joel, because I don't think I've heard of the Aruch Laner until this moment. So it's great being your friend and ally in discussions, because you're constantly throwing out sources casually that's making me broaden my own knowledge.
No, I appreciate that. So he's 18th century German. I'm thinking it through in Altoona. But so both of them, he's building off the Rashi. They make the suggestion that there's this category called the Gertoshav, who is a person who is not a Jew, but they live amongst the Jews in the land of Israel, and they take on some of the commandments, seven of them in particular, and one of them is to not be an idolater. And they rule, they say, well, if you're not an idolater, then you have to celebrate Shabbat, because Shabbat is about the relationship with the God, right? And if you're going to have that relationship, you have to have Shabbat. And so I imagine it might go the other way. If you don't have that relationship, you can't have Shabbat in the way it traditionally has stood in some ways. Although I'd probably be kicked out of a lot of places for making that comment.
We can start our own heretical yeshiva together.
That's right. We might be on different ends.
Exactly. We'll that would make it more productive, I think.
Yeah. So I want to ask you because you kept talking about, you know, when you have time, when you're, when you have time to prepare, that's why you do it on Saturday night, not on Friday night, when people have the time in their lives to do this. So I wanted you maybe to respond to this. The Vilna Gaon actually has this comment where, if you notice in Genesis, in the story of the first Sabbath, of God's Sabbath, it says two times, that God rested from the work, whatever malacha means, you know, creation that God did. And God ceased on the seventh day from all the work. And so, you know, the Vilna Gaon asks, well, why do you need both of those things? And he answers, well, on one, you stop, you know, you complete the work that you can complete, right? But on the other hand, even the work that you didn't complete, nonetheless, Shabbat comes, you have to act as if you completed it. And not, it's not about, you know, when you have the, when it's doing, when is it convenient for you? You have to make it as if it's convenient, no matter if it is or not. How do you respond to that?
Oh, you mean as a challenge? So, well, you're saying basically the argument would be Friday night Shabbat is the practice, and if you're going to say you're going to start at Saturday night, and your reason is, you know, my reason is, well, we want to really prepare, then.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter, because you can still experience it, because you're supposed to act as though it's all done. And let me tell you, if I had a different worldview and felt like I was beholden to these laws just because I am Jewish and they are Jewish laws, then I would quote the Vilna Gaon, right? This sort of 18th century Lithuanian sage and mystic. And I would say, see here, this is why I do it this way. But I don't feel beholden to it, so it becomes a question of practicality for me. And I'm going to nuance it a little bit, but the first practicality is, will I be able to feel as refreshed if my house is super messy? Because let me tell you, come Friday afternoon, my house is super messy, but come Saturday evening, it is not. And so, yes, if my goal is the experience of the oasis in time, is my experience of the refreshing waters of existence that I can dip into with proper preparation, I want to have a clean house that's going to help me get there. It won't be impossible to get there otherwise, but it's a really important part of it for me. I don't know what percentage of people are like this, but I would say it's probably not a low percentage. When my house is clean, I am mentally healthier. My anxiety level is lower. I'm more content. There's something about a clean house that just does it for me. So, as an example, and that's to say nothing of the food and everything that takes a long time, probably because I'm cooking it most of the time and I'm not the world's fastest chef. So that's one. In terms of the practicality for me, again, the aim is not to do the ritual as it's written in the codes. The aim is to access the oasis in time as it's described in the mystical literature. Kind of to take those descriptions of like the most beautiful, this feels like heaven on earth, and then to reverse engineer a ritual from that. And the nuance here for me is that increasingly, as we've been doing this, we've noticed that we're very social people. We're a very social family. And there's something about doing what in many ways is a Shabbat practice on the wrong day, so to speak. It can be kind of isolating. And though we have, you know, people from other traditions who come over, or people from the Jewish community to some degree who have been interested, it's harder to find that communal vibe. And we could build it over time, which is potentially what's going to happen. Or maybe sometimes we can start doing it on a Friday night, and you know what I mean? Preparing it in a different way to just be able to like go to synagogue or to invite people over, be invited over there, because there's something, and this is certainly in some of the oldest mentions of the Shechina, of this divine presence in the Mishnah, that it rests, she rests, the spirit of Shabbat rests between people. And it's hard to do alone, even as a family unit alone. So if there is a practical element in terms of experience, the refreshing waters of the Spirit, it is that a Friday night encounter, and we actually are planning on doing one, to Saturday evening as Oasis time as opposed to traditional Shabbat, that might really work for us. And so it's kind of an ebb and a flow. And I'll just say lastly that the blessing, the words of the blessings and the words of the prayers on Shabbat, they're not what I would call my God language. That's not how I articulate myself in spiritual poetry. And so part of the tension around Shabbat itself is it's a beautiful, if you kind of feel that theological structure, right? And if you believe in that or you can interpret in a way that's meaningful, it has so much potential because it's such, there's, the day is rich with blessing and prayer and meditation and all those kinds of intentions can be brought into the blessing and prayer, but I don't feel it. And those words actually, they don't bring me open, quite the contrary. So part of my tension with that night and that day is engaging in community or doing traditional practices, being invited to people's houses or, you know, inviting people over and they're expecting Shabbat and what they're getting is something different. What I like about Oasis Time is that these are the words that work for me, for us. They feel good. They feel inspiring. It's very direct. We don't have to do mental gymnastics and I don't want to skip anything because I really like what we're cultivating there.
Yeah. No, it's something you bring up that I just maybe, if I can reinforce a little bit, you know, from my personal experience, there's a big difference between doing Shabbat in a space where nobody around me is doing Shabbat versus having Shabbat in a space where everybody around me, or at least a lot of people around me. And you know, I grew up in an area of Los Angeles where you would walk to synagogue and there are a lot of people say Shabbat Shalom to you, right? Because they were all going to synagogue and they're all walking and there was like real, you know, it felt really amazing to be in, you know, the idea of like Barov Ha'am Hadrat Melech, that the glory of God is really in like a lot of people doing something sometimes. And Shabbat, I think sometimes feels like that. But also, I do find something personally very strong about like being in a space, not only where nobody's doing Shabbat, but even like in a shared residence where other people are like doing the opposite, right? They've got the TV on and I'm avoiding that room. There is something powerful to that too, I would say. But I hear that.
Tell me more about that, if you don't mind.
Go for it. Yeah.
You enjoy on some level or benefit from being sort of the outsider in a house where on Shabbat where people aren't observing.
Yeah. You know, it's countercultural in some ways. And I've done this both among other Jews, among non-Jews. And there is something to, I guess maybe it reinforces for me that I really believe in the practice, in spite of what's going on around me, because I'm willing to do that. It's a very different experience, right? It's like, you know, and also I'm a little more on edge for it because I'm looking for like, where am I going to step into a space without knowing it where it's like my Shabbat will be shocked in some ways. But at the same time, you know, and by the way, I think that any rabbi who serves pluralistic spaces experiences that. I remember the first time I was like in a Hillel space and students just pulled out their cell phones on Shabbat. And I was like, oh, well, and I tried not to react,
When you were working at a university, that like your students and you were working sort of as their rabbi and you were observing Shabbat, which doesn't involve cell phones in that traditional style of practice, and they were all pulling them out, right? And so you, as the rabbi in your role, experienced that sense of shock.
Yeah. So it's I do want to circle back to the Vilna Gaon for a minute, though, because I want to one step further with that, if that's okay, which is the question of, right, I think part of what he's saying isn't just that, like, because it says in the codes you need to, he is saying that, but, you know, you need to do it on Friday. But I think the other part of it is like, is there a benefit? I think he's claiming there's a benefit to, you know, setting a marker for yourself where I'm going to stop, even if I'm not ready to stop.
I totally agree, by the way. And did you have anything left to say? I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, go for it. I want to just trigger you to speak on it, so go for it.
Yeah, and I initially had thought that. I just forgot to say it in my response before. I think that's a wonderful teaching. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but the Me'or Enayim, who I guess lived a little bit before, they probably overlapped in their life. He was the rabbi of Chernobyl, the Chernobyl Rebbe. And he says, basically, that attitude, right? So like, let's say it's Saturday for me and I haven't put all of the cords away for the computer and I really like stuffing them back there because they're distracting and they're ugly, you know, or I didn't remember to put my own phone in the closet because I don't want to see it. I don't want to think about it. So it's out. You know what I mean? But the intention is to say, you know what? Life is good. Like, I have so much to celebrate. The world is complete right now. Everything is, like, and all of the rituals and the food and the rest and the songs and the good people around, that's meant to facilitate that mood. So, yeah, I completely agree with that as a practice. I don't think, for me, that doesn't mean that, therefore, I need to do it on Friday. What it means is, what a great intention. The world is always going to be, I hate to say it, the world is always going to be broken, right? We're not, in our lives, yeah. I'm open to being surprised, God, but unless that were to happen, being really surprising, we're not going to fix it all. And that means that whenever we're resting, and I think people who have families and who work really feel this, is we're always making a choice to say, enough is enough. I need to do the work of rest right now. I need to just bracket that part of my mind that wants to keep on ruminating about all the things that aren't clean and all the things that aren't delicious, you know, and all the things that aren't good. But right now, it's a celebration of all that we have and a celebration of all existence, because being here and getting to enjoy is part of being alive. What the Me'ora Na'im says about that is that applies to our inner lives as well. That there's this idea that we can do spiritual work, right? That's the work of transformation. That's the work of, basically, you have to acknowledge that you are not complete when you do spiritual work. Okay, it's feeling in and it's understanding, oh, there's actually something a bit misaligned inside. Now, the methods to go and help that evolve, there's so many. But the idea is it starts with the understanding that we are not complete as people. But the teaching is on Shabbat, or I would broaden it to Oasis time, we are complete as people. Even if we know on some level that there's still more work to do, again, all of us have work to do forever and ever. But in that mindset, it's about accepting and appreciating and celebrating who we are as whole beings, as peaceful, as calm, and people who are just, we're exactly as we were meant to be.
Yeah, that's it. I appreciate that. It makes me think about, you know, the rabbinic teaching of that Shabbat is 1/60th of the world to come, right? And this sense of, it's not that it actually is 1/60th, but more that it gives, if we make a space as if it's the world to come, as if it's this completely peaceful world, right? Then, yeah, we actually can have a taste of that, even if it's not fully the thing. And that itself is beneficial, potentially.
Yeah. And for listeners who might not be familiar with the term the world to come, it's either seen as heaven, some kind of blissful Garden of Eden-like paradise, or heaven on earth. So the idea that Shabbat is a taste of that. We get a taste of what it's like to live in heaven on earth.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about the universality of Shabbat in general, right? You know, the traditional rabbinic text actually see this as only for the Jews, right? That non-Jew, in fact, they go even to the extent in the tractate of the Talmud Sanhedrin, there's a statement by Rebbe Shimon, son of Lakish, that a non-Jew who has a Shabbat, even on a Tuesday, Monday, he says, even on a Monday, well, he doesn't say that. Someone later comes to say, even on a Monday, right, is liable for the death penalty. And other Midrashim say they've stolen a personal thing between us and God, right? How do you respond to that?
So first of all, I want you to respond and just kind of give a little bit of broad picture of what it means to be liable for the death penalty in rabbinic law. Can you just mellow that out a little bit, Rabbi?
So, well, okay, good. So I think part of it is in the rabbinic imagination. It's hard to say, I'll back up. In the medieval commentaries, Muslims say no one's killing anybody or executing anybody over this, right? That's a little bit ridiculous. What it really means is the rabbis have this imagination that the non-Jews have this like lawless system, and the only punishment they are capable of meting out is the death penalty kind of idea going on there. So I think it just means that they've committed a grievous act, is a way of saying that. So let's say they've committed a grievous act.
And even in that, the implication in that kind of punishment for it is, you're saying in the Talmud itself is this understanding that the law system outside of the Jewish system is lacking complexity or nuance? Is that kind of one of the assumptions of that statement?
Yes, it is. It is.
Okay, well, to some degree,
I'm projecting a little bit, but yes. Yeah,
but so, to some degree, if that is the case, I kind of like, I rest my case. So that statement is coming from a place that really lacks a lot of understanding about the other. And so I take everything in the Talmud with a grain of salt, like I do in the Torah as well. Like, I think that these are ancient voices that are coming from a particular place. And to quote my wise wife, it made sense at the time. There was something that they were bringing forward that was like, everything made sense at the time. There's always a context and a situation and where like these statements are arising. And I could look at how to answer your challenge kind of in a variety of ways. And one of them, just from a historical, you could say modern perspective, is that is a message that I don't see having particular relevance for these times. Because the reality is that there's a ton of allyship between the Jewish world and people outside the Jewish world. There's a ton of not just allyship, but sometimes for a lot of the Jewish world, people who have often more progressive values, for example, some of their best allies are from outside the Jewish world for so many topics. So the idea that we're going to make these hard and fast rules about who's in and who's out, or the idea that we just because some rabbi, you know, a couple thousand years ago says something that we need to therefore listen to it, I think most people in our modern world, Jewish and non-Jewish, would say, well, that's kind of an opinion from a long time ago. So that's one approach, is to kind of, I don't want to say scoff at, but, you know, diminish the importance of a statement, right? In Judaism, we like to increase the importance of statements the older it is, which is a really beautiful thing. And in the modern world, it tends to be the opposite. The older it is, all those folks are out of touch. They don't get us. So that's one approach. Now, I think the way that I'm speaking about it, it's apparent that's not the only voice inside of me. And that there, I think, yeah, in Jewishly, it's important to listen and to take consideration of all the voices, even if initially it might feel, oh, come on, you know, I don't get that. So let's say if I were to work this out inside the system, so to speak. So we have,
yeah,
the Torah lays out, what is it, 5 different commandments with regard to Shabbat. And those 5 commandments are, 2 of them have to do with sacrifice, I believe. And, you know, one of them is don't work, one of them is don't kindle fire, and one of them is don't carry wood or, you know, gather sticks on Shabbat. And
it actually doesn't say that directly. They just execute someone for doing that. So
sure. Well, I believe Maimonides reads that into his list of the 613 mitzvot. Regardless, yeah, there's not a whole lot there, but the Talmud brings out hundreds, thousands of do's and don'ts. Primarily don'ts. There's all these 39 categories and just a ton of new information. So without even getting into my sort of, I could say, criticism of how that's drawn out, which is, again, a more modern take, I could say if the Talmud is concerned, or if Reish Lakish in this instance is concerned with the people who are not in the Jewish fold practicing that Sabbath, the Sabbath not of a general rest and refreshment, but of lighting these candles and saying these blessings, and of saying this blessing over wine and you know, not picking up sticks, perhaps, or not kindling fire, or any of these things that is so specific. We get to the point, like, there's a lot of people who won't rip toilet paper on Shabbat today, right? Or some people will rip it if it's already serrated, you know, or some people won't use deodorant with a stick on Shabbat. I mean, like, some of these are, maybe you do, right? And so there's many different things that maybe, yeah, definitely you do. So many different, this gets so specific and incredibly, incredibly complicated. I would say that most learned Jews don't keep Shabbat because it's so vast and complex. But the idea is that if the Talmud says Shabbat, that's what they mean. They don't mean rest and refreshment. And they probably mean Friday night to Saturday night. So the argument from the inside of the law, I don't think is actually very difficult. It is, and again, I don't feel beholden to this, but this is what I'm doing. I'm not teaching. Like, right, when I'm writing this book, it's not going to be how to practice a traditional Jewish law-based Shabbat, no matter what your ethnicity. That's not the book. The book is, you know, blessings, songs, and ritual ideas for Oasis time, and it is inspired by that. I think, and based on, you know, it says in the Torah also that we're supposed to be a light unto the nations, which it's not my favorite statement in the world, but the idea is, I think if every culture could embrace this, like, how can we be of benefit to the world? And the best way, or certainly one of the best ways that Jews and Judaism can be a benefit to the world right now, is by sharing this really incredible treasure trove of ideas and practices for becoming more in tune, relaxed, and refreshed, and for celebrating all that we have in the midst of a very busy world, in the midst of a news feed that never seems to end. It's really, in that sense, even from the inner world of the Jewish legal system, we're not giving it, you know, one-to-one as a new idea in the world. We're translating it culturally and making really these blessings accessible to whole groups of people that never would have had access. So in that sense, it's a really valuable thing to do, and I don't think it contradicts any Jewish law, certainly none that you've named it so far and none that I'm aware of.
Well, it's so good. So I want to actually, I'll push one, and then for the next question, I'll pull back, but if that's okay, is I think that there definitely are some medieval sources who understand the statement of Reish Lakish, Rabbi Shimon, son of Lakish, as saying this is cultural appropriation, right? That this is, you know, that if I went and I celebrated, you know, I don't know, Ramadan as a non-Muslim, I don't know if that works in the same way, because I don't know how Islam approaches that, but, you know, if I went and took Mass, you know, or did something like Mass, I think a Catholic person might be up in arms, or the church might be up in arms. That's their practice. How dare I steal it? So I don't know. How do you respond to that? Maybe it's not a concern. I don't know. So.
Well, here's how I view it. And in any community that I have encountered where we're doing, you could call it interspirituality or ritual sharing, there are going to be people who are very enthusiastically sharing practices and saying, these are medicine, these are helpful, these are healing. And there's usually people in those communities that don't like that either. And this is not unique to Judaism. The fact that there are some medieval voices that say this is cultural appropriation, if we were to, and they probably mean to share Shabbat exactly as it is. Can you clarify?
Probably. It's not so clear. And some voices, I will say, you know, there are definitely voices in the medieval commentaries who want to limit this statement. And so that's what they do. They say, well, yeah, that means like having an exact 25 hours in which you have the following practices, you know, word for word. If you like do one thing out of that norm, then you're okay.
Yeah, so there was a time, for example, when I was engaging in Israel in Orthodox Judaism, and I, because of my mother's conservative conversion, I was not recognized as Jewish by those crowds, and so I would observe Shabbat, and I'd always break it in some way, and that was okay. So basically, it's pretty, according probably to most, if not all, of these medieval voices you're quoting, right? We could do the research another time and verify, but the only way to culturally appropriate would to be keeping a very precise Shabbat practice, and so precise that it's quite difficult to do, unless you're just going to say, I'm going to lie here in a dark room and eat food. You know what I mean? Do they have to say the blessings? Do they have to say kiddush? Is it they have to pray? Like, what? It would be extremely difficult for someone who wasn't highly trained to actually pull that off, and only then would they meet the bar of cultural appropriation. So if that's the case, first of all, like, we can kind of right off the bat say, no one's going to do that. And if they do that, they will have achieved such a rare feat that, like, they deserve it, in my opinion. They've earned it. But let's even say, for the sake of argument, that these medieval voices, or modern voices, perhaps, there might even be some of those around that are saying, this is cultural appropriation. Oasis time is an appropriation of Shabbat. I would tell people to trust their own sense of rightness in the world. That no one's going to force them to do this. And I am not the only rabbi. I am not the most well-known rabbi who's advocating for this. So our teacher, Rabbi Arthur Green, writes in several places in his writings that he thinks the world is in need of Shabbat. And he doesn't mean anything other than what I'm talking about. He probably means, I don't know exactly, to be honest, what his vision looks like in particular, but he is saying that this is a huge asset that Judaism can add to humanity. And as you know, our teacher, Art, is very conscious of these issues and wants to be a very mensch-like presence in the world, a good person, a good influence in our world. And so just to say, I have been in indigenous sharing circles where there has been a pipe passed around with tobacco, where there has been saging. You have people burning sage and smudging for the sake of healing. And I have had people from those communities empower me to use sage on my own. Like, this is healing. This is medicine. You should do this. It's helpful. It's like giving someone medicine. And so there are also people I know of in those communities that don't like that. But at the end of the day, people need to find their own way through it. If someone is really staunch in opposition to, you could call it, cultural appropriation, and they have, let's say, a very broad definition of what cultural appropriation is, they need to ask themselves, how does this feel to me to be practicing a practice inspired by Shabbat that some rabbis are saying is okay and other rabbis are questioning? Okay, like, that's going to exist in every community. And so I think there are some things that are appropriative in this world. Like, there's a big pharmaceutical company that goes into sub-Saharan Africa and finds a plant that has been cultivated and really used and with very specific purposes for generations by a hunter-gatherer group as an appetite suppressant during times of drought. And this is a real case. And then they take this plant that was shown to them by a particular group of people who have been using it in times of drought probably for thousands of years. And then they distill the active ingredient and they make a diet pill and they make millions or billions, and the people who gave it to them don't get any of it. And now they're not doing well because their life situations change. I mean, that to me is an ethical line, and I don't like that. And I will call that out. That's not okay. But when it comes to things like freely given cultural gifts, I think we need to be aware of where they're coming from, but there's always going to be mixed opinions from group to group. And I think people should be empowered to make their own choices.
Thank you. No, that's really interesting. And I want to, you know, you said that that Art Green, Rabbi Art Green, suggests also, like you, that there's a need for a universal Shabbat. Like, everyone needs Shabbat, I guess is the way maybe that.
Yeah, he hasn't, I don't think, gone into detail about what that looks like. Yes, but he's saying Jews, I think he says Jews should be evangelicals or proselytizing Shabbat, something like that. We should be missionaries for Shabbat, I believe the term that he used in one of his books.
Great. So the question, I guess, that comes from that is Shabbat morally necessary? Is having a Shabbat?
Well, you know what I really like about that question is it, I was going to say something a minute ago that was going to a little bit call into question this idea of appropriation, because the Western legal system has its foundations in biblical law. So biblical law is the law of the ancient Israelite people. And as a culture, almost across the board, I think it'd be a rare person who would challenge this. We have accepted that it's okay to quote unquote appropriate a system of law because it is a moral issue as opposed to a ritual issue or a spiritual issue. But if we look at this question, like you were just saying, is taking rest a moral issue? To be honest, I don't think I could give a philosophical answer, but I love the idea that it is, because if it is moral to rest and to find that spiritual refreshment, certainly it's moral for ourselves, right? Morality tends to be how do we treat others most of the time, but it's good for us. I would say it's good for family. It's good for community. It's good for friends. It's good for the world. And if something's good for the world, doesn't that make it moral? So if we look at it through that lens, could it be appropriation? Because thou shalt not kill, right? And laws of tort laws about personal injuries or personal damages of property, these are all, they could be traced back in one way or another, a lot of them, to the Hebrew Bible. So how would the Sabbath differ? Or let's say even just a society like ours that has weekends. Is that cultural appropriation? Is the weekend and if the answer is no, and I think most people would say it's no, where do we draw that line?
Yeah, no, I think it's also interesting because I think I wonder if the morality is not just for yourself, like that we as people need rest. But the other thing is not only do we personally need rest, but whether or not that by us taking a rest, it gives other people a break and a rest, right? People work for us. People, don't have to keep their stores open that we're going to go shopping at and so forth. And so I wonder if it's not just a personal thing. It actually affects the rest of the world if you're willing to take a day of rest.
Yeah, I mean, I remember being in Paris, France in the early 2000s, and I was trying to go shopping for, it was bread or something, bread and cheese. That's pretty much what I ate on that trip. And it was a Sunday, and everything was closed. And I remember thinking, like, what gives? I just want to buy some bread and some cheese. And maybe it was where I was in the city, but it really felt like everything was shut down. And on the one hand, that's frustrating as a consumer, but there is something really nice about that. Or, I mean, much easier examples being in Jerusalem on a Saturday, that it's really hard to buy stuff and possibly illegal. Now, whether these things should be made illegal is another question, but basically, it's a really beautiful concept that our rest, if we're employers, can actually facilitate the rest of others. And there's probably a fairly good way to articulate the morality of rest, which, by the way, would be a fantastic name for an essay or a book, The Morality of Rest or The Morality of Shabbat, if it doesn't already exist.
I like that. That's you know, it also, by the way, I'm thinking about you know, the flip side in the cultural appropriation question, right? There's a Jewish law, a traditional Jewish law about what we call Darchei HaEmori, like the ways of the Amorites, right? That we shouldn't do things that other cultures or other religions are doing, which I don't know if it's always about cultural appropriation, but one of the things that becomes an exception to that is if it's beneficial, right?
I want to point out that for our listeners, this is Joel has a dog where he is, and this dog is currently having a chew toy, a squeaky toy. So I hope it's not distracting, but if it is, just know that that dog is experiencing such a great oasis time right now that it is just really tapping into the joy of all being with what it's engaging with.
I'm going to close my door, actually.
Okay, so all right. That's a great idea.
I apologize about that. I think everything comes together at the wrong time, right? But nonetheless, I take the break. I guess I had another question.
I just wanted to say one more thing on that topic. The idea of the morality too. I mean, there's people right now who are putting forth, like promoting a universal Shabbat. I've seen it online. I was posting about this and people were showing me different resources. Basically, if people were to treat a weekly Sabbath as a no driving day, which is the traditional Jewish way, I mean, because you can't light a fire, so a combustion engine. Now, an electric car, I wonder, like, could Teslas be driven? I'm sure there's people who have opinions on that. But the idea of consuming less and burning less fossil fuels, I mean, that's a fairly compelling case. So in its best sense, forgetting just the rest, you could have a weekly screen-free day, right, where you're not looking at the news or your kids aren't looking at, you know, YouTube, where you're not having to look at social media. As much as some of us really like those things, it is helpful to take a break and remember just what's right in front of us. So a weekly screen-free day, a weekly buy-nothing day, right? Usually money isn't handled. It's not like a shopping day. It's a weekly buy-nothing day. And it's this earth regenerative day. I mean, can you imagine if the world did that one day a week even? And when we get into this territory of, well, I think it is helpful to have a different balance between work and rest that our society has, not just work in the sort of going to work sense, but then the fixing stuff, doing stuff, always moving. It is permissible within Jewish law to extend Shabbat all the way to Tuesday, I believe. So can you imagine a culture, I mean, maybe that wasn't having so many necessary prohibitions during like Oasis time, but finding some balance where you could have really intentional enjoyment and just celebration of all that we have as a balance to a more, you know, intensive work life. There is, I think, I could imagine a situation, like I've heard about, there's a culture in Burkina Faso, so a member of their culture, he's a spiritual teacher named Maladoma Somme, and he says that in our culture, we work and then we take a little bit of time to rest. And the way he describes it is in their culture, they do a lot of, they do ritual, they do spiritual practices, and when they need to, they do work. So could Oasis time be this idea of kind of extending it farther so that there could be more of this balance between not just enjoyment, but also letting the earth rest, like using the cars less? Yeah, these are some of the morality topics that come up in my mind as I contemplate.
Yeah, it's it is an interesting thing because the traditional culture in rabbinic Judaism is that, right, the Torah says, Sheshi Yamim Tavod Vatzita Chol Melachtecha, that 6 days you should work and do all of your work, your labor, right? V'yom HaShishi Shabbat L'Adonai Elohecha, and the seventh day is for the Lord your God, right, is Shabbat. And there, the rabbis will understand is it's like, you actually are obligated to work for 6 days, right? That it's not, we always, and you're allowed to add from Shabbat into the week and so forth, but in fact, you may be required to. But there is an idea that work is also necessary, so it's an interesting balance. And I wonder if that's somewhere between those two. I'm actually really curious. Somebody like me, Matthew, who is never going to do Oasis time, right? In the sense that you're having.
Well, if we invite you over to our house, maybe if you're in the same city.
Oh, great. Yeah, you know that's fair. That's fair. No, but I mean, I'm going to stick to the traditional Shabbat. That's my practice. That's what I've been doing.
For sure.
I have many reasons for that. you know, but what can I learn from Oasis Time? What can I take from it?
Well, someone like yourself, I would encourage you to think broadly about what Jewish practices that you love, that you found very useful, could be translated. And I don't mean like Hebrew to English. I mean translated culturally, could be made accessible as an offering to people. I think that's because you have such a really rich traditional Jewish life, and you probably know deeply rituals that I'm barely aware of, or certainly that I don't know experientially. And so, that's partly if you have a sense, and I, from, you know, being your friend, I know you do, of like being of benefit to the world. You might not have the same universal aspirations that I do, but are there things that you think of in your Jewish life that you think are useful for people? And could there be a way that you could talk about it as an invitation, at least for dialogue in the broader scene? Like, let's say you're at an interfaith dialogue event. What would you bring that you think would be a good addition to that if we're contemplating a particular topic?
You know, I appreciate that, because if I talk about something that happened with me, I used to be at an interfaith space in Syracuse, at Syracuse University, with other chaplains. And there was this thing where we'd begin our meetings with like a little meditation. Of course, I brought, unlike there are many Jews who do meditation, meditation isn't my thing. I brought a text that we would study together. Which, by the way, as a kind of a side note to that, the follow-up to Reish Lakish in the Talmud there saying non-Jews can't have Shabbat is Rabbi Yochanan saying non-Jews can't study Torah. Nonetheless, I brought them Torah. And actually, one of the chaplains reached out to me, and he said, you know, we started to have these meetings amongst just the chaplains and not with the rest of the administration. He said, you know, we'd love to bring what you're doing here, which is, we'll call it like, what am I learning time? And each week, a chaplain will bring something to study together. And I think there was something very powerful of that with that in our learning to dissect text together and learning to be readers of holy text together. And I really enjoyed doing that. So maybe I have done that a little bit, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I mean, you think about Torah study as an example. A lot of people, I can say, in sort of like the spiritual but not religious world, the New Age world, tend to see the intellect as an obstacle. And in Jewish study, actually, one of the systems that agrees with Judaism in many ways is Buddhism, the sort of this Buddhist study being part of a lot of monastic practice. The idea that you can have a holy or a spiritual experience with the mind, and that the intellect can transport you to something really sacred, that is not so well appreciated in our world. So that's another example of something that could be brought. I love that story for that reason. So that's one thing, and I think that's, in many ways, like for you, Rabbi Joel Goldstein, that's kind of something that I could say about what you could learn from Oasis Time. But if we happen to be in the same place again physically, and I hope it happens, I would invite you into the experience. And I think you would have something to reflect on. I mean, again, whether you loved it or not, I think it would be of interest to you. And I would also share with you some of the blessings that we've composed, because in my opinion, they're really beautiful. And there's a lot there. And the other thing we're doing, which I haven't started publishing yet, but it's going to be in this book, is there is a Jewish tradition, like in Hasidic world, of taking tunes that they heard around and then like rewriting them with Jewish words. Or Martin Luther also did that. It was part of his success, as he took sort of the pub songs in Germany and he rewrote them as hymns. So I'm taking songs like the Queen's song Bohemian Rhapsody, and I'm writing it with kind of Oasis Time intentions, because there's something so nice about singing together. And in a Jewish Shabbat practice, if people, you get enough critical mass, people can sing the tunes together, these Hebrew songs, these like praise songs for Shabbat and for God. And I want to have that experience. And people already know so many melodies in common in our culture. So the idea is to take those and to rewrite them with that intention. So basically, I can't tell you what you'd learn, but if you want to kind of, you know, take a dip in the Oasis sometime, and we have an opportunity, come over to our place or whatever in the future, I have a feeling there would be insight in some way.
I would love to take you up on that opportunity. I think it would be very beneficial to me. So, God willing, we'll have that space. I'll close with this. Who knows? Maybe it won't close us. But maybe I thought you could share one of those songs and one of those blessings for us.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is something called the Good Vibes Blessing, and it's something that we read at our house. What I do is, inspired by the Jewish practice of Kiddush, which is a blessing over wine that brings holiness, I pour water and I overflow the cup so that the blessings can be abundant, which is inspired by a Hasidic practice from the Babov community, where you're sort of, your blessings are supposed to be overflowing on Shabbat, so people overflow the cup even during Shabbat itself. So I overflow the cup with water, I pick it up, and I say these words: as our universe has unfolded from a time beyond time up until this day, there have always been periods of manifestation and periods of abiding, periods of change and periods of stasis, times of disorder and times of harmony, moments of work and moments of rest. The ancestors perceived this pattern and were gifted with the blessing of Shabbat, an oasis in time, a sacred inheritance to honor and celebrate rest, pleasure, joy, and the spirit, a time of liberation from constrictions, when we come together on this day and say, with full hearts, everything is good, everything is complete, the crooked is made straight, and the night shines like the day. We bless this day together that we may drink from its refreshing waters, and we offer this practice to any other person or community who can find inspiration and benefit from it. Blessed be this sacred oasis time, and may this day connect us to the abundance of the universe for rest, for pleasure, and for peace.
All right. And, you know, I will say I prefer it with wine, but I'll take the water one.
Well, we are a non-alcohol drinking family, and if anyone wants to drink wine at our table or at theirs, they're more than welcome. And it's still a work in progress. There's some elements of it. I'm like, do I just want to take the word Shabbat out? Do I want to just talk about oasis time? You know, do I want to mention the ancestors, so to speak? So there's a few elements here I'm working with, and that's part of a project I'm doing right now at the University of Victoria. But in essence, this is some of the material we're creating, and it's in hopes that people will be able to find the rest and the refreshment that they're needing in their lives. So in the same way that I am inspired by Shabbat for this work, if people are inspired by Oasis Time and make up something different, you know, kol hakavod, you know, go for it. You know, I wish them all the best, because at the end of the day, for us, it's about finding that space, you know, in our lives, within and without, for connecting to what really matters.
And with that, maybe I'll say one thing, you know, just to end. You know, I wonder if this challenges all of us to look, even if you're Jewish, if you're whatever religious practice or tradition you come from, as to whether or not there are elements of that that are useful for the world and should be shared with the world. And I think, Matthew, I think you're challenging and inspiring all of us to do that and to look deeply into our own practices and see what really shouldn't be kept just for us. And with that, is there a special greeting we have for Oasis Time, like Shabbat Shalom? What do I say?
I have been telling people, may Oasis be with you.
I love it. So Shabbat Shalom and may Oasis be with you. And I really appreciate this conversation and this chance to be on your podcast, which is great. I don't know how often it happens, but I encourage everyone to listen to it, because Matthew, in my learning with you, you're just such a deep and inspirational thinker, and you challenge my Judaism every day, and I appreciate that.
So. And I appreciate you as someone who appreciates that. Rabbi Joel Goldstein, I really appreciate you having on the show.
Thank you
so much for joining. And I'm Rabbi Matthew Ponak. Thanks for listening to We're In This Shift Together. Until next episode, may you find the rest and the spiritual refreshment that you deserve. And may you build a structure in your life, even if just for half an hour in an evening, where you could truly tap in to the refreshing nature of reality.